how can you be so incredibly clever, but you can't find your shoes and socks? Like that dynamic.
Welcome to today's podcast episode. This is a conversation that I had a little while ago with Alison from The Incremental Shift, and I'll tell you a little more about Alison in a minute. But this is an episode that I think is going to be really helpful for absolutely anyone who has a family or is considering having a family in terms of raising children. I think that even though we're talking about the struggles and the adversity and the challenges that a lot of parents and families do face when they have neurodiverse family members, because it can be a bit different, it's not only those families that do have neurodiverse or neurodivergent family members that are going to take something from this conversation, because even if everyone in your family unit is neurotypical, and again, like the spectrum, right? We're all sitting somewhere on the spectrum. But if you are someone who is like, you know what, I just can't relate to labels and diagnosis and all of that stuff, I think you'll still take things away from this conversation, because raising kids is hard work. It's often one of those things that you might find yourself saying like, oh, I've fallen into these patterns of just doing what works in the moment, but maybe it's not working long term, and you might be feeling absolutely burnt out from, of course, not only the mental load, but the physical load, actually doing everything and carrying the family unit. There are still things in this conversation that are going to be helpful for you regardless. Like regardless of anyone in your family, whether they have a diagnosis or they don't. And so Alison Bolson is a family dynamics and neurodiversity strategist. I loved speaking with Alison. This is definitely one of those interviews that I took stuff away from. And, you know, I finished this recording and I was chatting with friends and I was chatting with Brendan, and I was saying, oh, you know, there was this part that was really helpful. Then there was that part that was really helpful. And I know that I've mentioned about certain things that I missed with my own kids in terms of like not really picking up on autism traits sooner. And I referenced this episode. In that episode, I told you to keep an eye out and an ear out for this one. I am having a little bit of a play with the dynamics of the podcast and really trying to lean into having more solo episodes, more kind of, I guess, personal reflections and more relevant topics. But I had this interview sitting here and I just had to get it up, because I'm sure that there will be people out there who really need to hear from Alison. So we cover a lot. We talk about why families would seek a diagnosis, when to seek a diagnosis. We talk about whether or not it's something that you even want to disclose to your child, the pros, the cons, the stigma. We talk about different systems that could be really helpful for the family network. And we also talk about expectations. And I think expectations is a topic for everyone, because so often we have such big expectations on little people. And I think that comes from us ourselves, you know, feeling the weight of the mental and physical load and the pressure we put on ourselves and perfectionism and all of that stuff. So, Alison, as I mentioned, she's a family dynamics and neurodiversity strategist. She loves to provide insight, education, and practical strategies. She has 4 neurodiverse children herself. She gets it. She is also autistic and has ADHD as well. Alison works closely with families to help support, guide, and develop, I guess, goals for the different seasons of their family life. So often in parenting, it feels like we're alone, and it really can feel like you're drowning and you're like, I don't know which way is up. And that's what Alison does. She aims to support families and help them figure out which way is up and to help people feel calmer and more at peace with everything. I have popped the link directly to the Incremental Shift website in our episode description and show notes, and also the link directly to follow Alison on Instagram as well, because she's always sharing little bits of information. And again, I think if you are, like, if any of this relates to you, it's just comforting. That's what it is. It's comforting to know that you are not alone, even when it feels like you are. In the past, I've shared a couple of books on my Instagram story, and I just wanted to mention those as well for any parent or carer who, you know, is wondering maybe if there are autism traits or maybe ADHD traits in their children. There are some great books that I do share often. One is called I Am Autistic, and it is written by Chanel Moriah, and she also has one about ADHD. And these books are just really informative, they're easy to digest, they're great for the whole family, and they unpack different traits in a way that kids, I think, can find it like just easier to understand. Reading these books with my kids, and you know, they'll go and pick them up and flick through them themselves, it gives them the language to understand what's going on. And I think that that's really important, because when a child can say, oh, I'm feeling overwhelmed because I struggle with making decisions, or I'm finding this really hard because I've had a week of masking at school, or why aren't I the same as other kids? It just helps them to understand, look, maybe the difficulties that you're having with socializing are more to do with, you know, just the way that your brain is wired, and it's not about you being bad or not as good as anyone else. Again, it's just very comforting to have that insight. So let's get into my episode with Alison. Again, those details are in the show notes. I'm uploading this as a bit of a bonus episode because, as I said, I just want this conversation to be available for anyone who feels like they need it. Regardless of whether you're a parent of a neurodivergent child or not, this is a helpful conversation for sure. Thank you so much for pressing play, and I look forward to speaking with you soon. Just quickly, a word from today's sponsors. Unless, of course, you're one of our Venti members, in that case, there are no ads and your episode is about to keep playing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Alison, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to have a chat with me.
You're so welcome, Kylie.
You have a really interesting job title. You are a family dynamics and neurodiversity support, I'm going to say, strategist.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
What does that mean?
So I'll go into a little bit of a history about how I came to do what I do now. And it very much started a long time ago, 35 years ago, in fact, when there was family diagnosis of ADHD and neurodiversity. And I think, you know, at the time it just is what it is and you just go through life. So I didn't think much of it until I had my own kids, of course. And with my own kids, there were flags from very early on. I'm talking like from 6 months old, there were flags. And important to note here too that I did have, I had a degree in education, so I was not coming, you know, with unrelated knowledge of these flags. And I had come from a family full of doctors and medical professionals. So I had a bit of an experience there. So fast forward to my own children getting diagnosed. I think a lot of people go through this process of, I have a suspicion. There's a suspicion that, something's not quite right, but I can't work out what it is. And so you go to your GP, you go through the process, and, you know, through chatting with other people and everything, you finally save enough money to get a diagnosis, because they're not cheap. And of course, there's the waiting list. And depending on who you get it from, the diagnosis can come with great information or no information. And you're left with this kind of, well, I was left with this kind of feeling of, well, now what? Like, now what do I do with that? And we had a great psychologist, a neurodivergent psychologist, who was wonderful in explaining, well, this is what's going on for your child. This is why they're doing what they're doing. And I think that all comes to a bit of a natural end, whether it's mental health care plan or whether it's, you know, funds fizzle out or, you know, you forget to make the appointments even. These things, it kind of just fizzles out, or you then get sent to speech therapy or occupational therapy, and you do learn some amazing things. In OT, for example, we absolutely did, you know, regarding emotions and social skills and fine motor, gross motor, all of those things. But there was still something that was missing for me personally. It was like I was learning all of these things in isolation about my child, about my favorite human, but there was something still felt quite disconnected. I spent over 10 years as a stay-at-home mum because I have four kids. So I had, with my own neurodivergence, I have ADHD and autism, and I needed something to tick my brain over. So I studied everything that I could and got my own diagnosis, and through my own self-discovery, my own grieving process too, for the life that I had, the life that I thought was me. And, you know, you overprocess all of the childhood things and friendships, what happens socially, and why did I say these things, and relationships and all of those things. And I observed my own triggers, I guess, in my own current environment as a stay-at-home mum. And I just crafted ways to minimize them for myself, but also when I observed my children, I was seeing their triggers and seeing, you know, what can I do? What, like, they can't do it. They don't know any better. So what can I do to help them to get through this thing, which is clearly a triggering event for them, or it's eliciting some sort of emotional response that you can see is really troubling. So that's kind of how I really got into it. And then I just started sharing it with friends, and they were getting success from it. And then it just turned into what it is now, which is me providing support for families in this kind of, it's a delicate area of, you know, home life, but you're also matching personalities, labels, diagnosis, and how kids learn, and all, like, it's just encapsulated everything of my life up until now. And I love what I do, because parents get instant recognition of what is going on in this environment. You're like, oh, I got it. That's actually what's happening. It's not that they, you know, don't want to follow my instruction. It's that they actually can't. And this is why.
Did you have a diagnosis as a child or an adult?
So I got mine when we were getting my second or third child diagnosed. That was when I got my diagnosis. And in hindsight, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And I already knew, in regards to my own upbringing, that there were these tendencies, these behaviours, these traits there. So it was of absolutely no surprise to me.
With your kids, you've mentioned that you've got four, and I can only imagine how busy that is. Are you happy to share their diagnosis journey as well? Like, do all four of your children present to have a similar neurodivergence, or is it sort of a bit different from, you know, one to the other?
That's a really interesting question, because they are all, so I guess their official diagnosis is, so they are all autistic. In the old definition, you would say that they are Asperger's, and they all have ADHD. So three of them are inattentive and one of them is combined type. And they are all gifted as well. So they have that twice exceptional diagnosis there, which is both wonderful and super challenging, where how can you be so incredibly clever, but you can't find your shoes and socks? Like that dynamic.
And that is something that I know so many parents do struggle with. Like, how can you retain so much information about something you're fixating on, but literally need me to remind you to brush your teeth?
Because that's boring, Kylie. That is so boring. And it is so, looking after your teeth is a long-term problem. Like, it's a not now issue. I'm not going to get holes in my teeth if I don't brush them tonight. And so they don't, it's executive functioning. It is so, I know you talk about pain versus pleasure. That is so boring to them, but such a necessity from an adult mind.
So what do you say to parents who feel really frustrated with that particular pain point, Alison? And I know that we're jumping ahead a little bit and there's so many different areas we can cover. But just whilst we're on that topic, if someone came to you and said, look, my partner is losing their mind because they cannot understand how our child can remember all of these intricate details, but yet they're struggling with basic tasks, what do you say to a parent in that situation?
First thing is lower your expectations. So ADHD kids, whether they are gifted or not, ADHD kids are 30% behind in those types of activities. So, you know, what you're expecting a seven-year-old to do is, don't think of them as a seven-year-old in terms of executive functioning activities. So a lot of, even within my own house in the mornings, for example, there's two of us to get everybody ready. And yes, there's lots of us and all of that, but there is one of us that generally just chaperones the four children around, because ADHD kids wake up tired. There's a million executive functioning activities to do before they even get out the door. So they, if you left it up to them, they would have no capacity to then get through a school day. So I save them from that. And I've seen with my eldest children that they do pick it up when it's appropriately, when they are developmentally ready to pick those tasks up. So lower your expectations for sure. And as much as you can, and I know this is such a challenge, to don't take it personally. And it is what it is. And just surrender to that component of your child.
When it comes to executive functioning, for anyone who hasn't really heard this terminology before or just feels a little bit unsure what we're talking about, what exactly are we referring to when we talk about executive functioning?
So we're talking about planning, organizing, implementing step-by-step activities that some people don't have to think about. It just automatically happens. Other people can't think about them. They just do not have the capacity to think about the logical order that things need to go in. And I think that's another challenge of autistic ADHDs, because they can have, for example, with myself, I can have the most insanely planned out thing, but I can't even get started because my task initiation is so low. And it could even be something that I'm super excited about, but my ADHD holds me back from actually starting. And autistic me is going, but hang on, it's all planned. Like, it's, you just got to follow it. You just got to start. And ADHD me says, I don't even really want to start. So it's very conflicting.
And there's a lot of comorbidity between autism and ADHD, isn't there? Because I just know myself, when we were going through the process of getting a diagnosis for one of my boys, I brought up autism when we were exploring ADHD, and the pediatrician said, oh, there's so much crossover that we won't even look at autism right now. We will just deal with the inattentive ADHD. And then if those autistic traits still present, that's when we'll deal with that. And I completely understand that rationale. But now, a little bit further into it and actually having an autism diagnosis, I'm like, oh, I wish that we just kind of addressed everything that was going on as a whole.
Yes, I can empathize with you there. I think that certainly if you treat the ADD, then the symptoms can just sort themselves out and on you go, and that's great. But for the people that I see, if you treat the ADD and not the autism, then the autism, both the qualities and the challenges just increase. So you've like looked at the border of a puzzle, but not the pieces in the middle. And I think that when you put all the pieces in the middle, then you see the magical picture.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So you can't, I feel like, and I think that was even with one of the things with my training, when I did ADHD training, I was like, but that's only part of the picture. That's not the whole picture. So it's tricky, because I can appreciate where the pediatrician's coming from, but there's also a bit more to it than that.
When it comes to getting a diagnosis, one of the questions I am often asked is why? Like, why seek a diagnosis? And then just to piggyback off that question, something else that I've noticed a lot is that there are parents who really don't want their kids to know about that diagnosis, which, again, like playing devil's, not devil's advocate, but seeing both sides, I do understand in terms of stigma and, you know, not wanting someone to feel like they've been put into a certain box or whatever it is. But then at the same time, I tend to think that a diagnosis can be so powerful. What do you think about all of that? Like, why get a diagnosis? And then what are the benefits or the cons for your child knowing about that diagnosis?
That's a very complex question, because I think it's where there's two worlds colliding at the moment, which is the, you know, when I was growing up, the stigma associated with being diagnosed ADHD, let alone Asperger's or autistic back then, the stigma was awful. Whereas now it's colliding with, no, neurodiversity isn't as bad as we first were making it out to be all those years ago. That said, I think that only you know your child and how they would cope with their own diagnosis or their own discovery. I know for my children, they, and for most of my clients too, the children know that they're different. They know that they don't fit in socially. They know that they are struggling. And they're curious enough to go, why? Why am I struggling? Why is this so easy for Joe Bloggs and it's so hard for me? So when I explain it to them, like, and I'm talking simple terms, like, you know, you have autism and sometimes autistic people struggle with getting along with people. Sometimes sometimes autistic people have, you know, they have very rigid thoughts. And I give examples of myself and then I'll ask them, you know, have you ever felt like you don't fit in? And they will instantly go, yeah, absolutely, Mum. Like, this happened today and I felt really weird in that moment. And like, what was with that, Mum? And I'll say to them, like, well, this is autism, love. Like, this is not you're less than. This is not you're a shit human for not being able to communicate. This is you. And like, they will want to know, so what do I do, Mum? Because it feels weird. So what do I do? Because they want to fit in.
Yeah. I have seen with my boys, one of them more so than the other, but since having a diagnosis, it is like he has just exhaled and takes the mask off. And on one hand, I'll observe him and, you know, in conversations away from him, obviously not in front of him, but I have shared, you know, I've spoken to, you know, my friends and of course Brendan and my mum as well. And I've said, like, it almost seems like now, I don't know how I missed it, because it's like the autism traits have gone up a level and perhaps they do just intensify at certain ages and certain points. But my gut instinct, for what it's worth, is that, oh no, he's just not masking anymore. Like, he's masking less in front of other people. And like, when Brendan and I went away to Bali recently, my mum looked after the boys. And that first night before we left, we were all together. And that was the first time I've seen my son be fully himself in the presence of her. And it was really, really nice. Like, I was like, oh, look, you're just being you. Like, you're whizzing around and you're doing your little, like, shh, shh, like your little things that you do. And I think that that freedom to be fully himself came from having the diagnosis.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. And I think that he could probably verbalize that to you as well.
Yeah, and he does. And both of the boys are really great at explaining their own experiences. But yeah, I just wondered about that whole, I guess, not telling your kids. And it's one of those things, right, that every family has to weigh up for themselves and work out the pros versus the cons and your own personal feelings and your family approach, I guess. I just wonder if not talking about it and not giving your kids the language or that intel is adding to that stigma.
I 100% think it is adding to the stigma. And I also, when I explain certain ADHD traits, I say to them, like, this is not an excuse as to why you can't do X, Y, and Z. This is a reason, but it also means that you have to work harder in these areas. Like, unfortunately, you do. In these areas, hyper fixation areas, you don't have to work hard at all.
So when it comes to parents who perhaps are starting to have that inkling that maybe they want to pursue a diagnosis and they go through the process, I think it is really important for them to know a little bit more about exactly what you said at the start, like in terms of you go through this process and then you get to the end of it and it's like, well, there you go, there's your diagnosis, but you don't actually then get a roadmap to follow in terms of what to do next or how that diagnosis can benefit you. It's very much like, oh, yes, you've paid the fee, here's the diagnosis, on your way. And so that's where you step in, right? That's where you're that person for families who is like, okay, these are the areas that we need to look at. Yep. When you first meet with a family, obviously you must complete a lot of questionnaires and go through a lot of dynamic stuff. But what are just some of the questions that you might ask someone who has just come to you and said, Alison, I've just gotten this diagnosis, help?
Yes. So just to backtrack a little, there's the reasons for a diagnosis, in my opinion, is if your child is struggling at school and they need extra support from the school, then that is the diagnosis is the only path that I'm aware of. There are certain schools who will put in supports, informal supports, when they can. But if your child needs more, then they need to apply for funding and they need to go through their process. So the formal title label is what assists that process. So it can be as simple and clinical as that. But also, I think too, as a parent, you see the struggle that your child goes through and you want them to, you know, in reflection, you go, I don't want them to do what happened to me. So if this has brought about so much positive self-identity for me, then I want that for them now, when they're seven, not when they're in their 30s, when they're seven. So if that label then gives them a springboard or a platform to, in your case, for your son to take his mask off, what a gift. What a gift that at that age, at 10, he can do that then, rather than mask and camouflage for the next 25 years until he self-discovers it himself. So I think it's an expensive process, but if you are, your reasons for it are your reasons for it. And I think that it's brought wonderful things for the families that I deal with and my own family. So there is, but I understand there is still the stigma around it as well. In regards to what we do, yes, lots of questions in the first session is lots of questions. And, you know, the general questions like family, health, you know, any diagnosis that you have. But we also talk about environment. So we talk about what, from a sensory processing point of view, from your house setup point of view, what it's like for, you know, your school, your child's classroom setup. Do they go to after school activities? What are the transitions like? You know, do you do the same transitions from home to school every day? Are they loud? Is mum on the phone? You know, all of those kinds of things. We talk about nighttime routines. We talk about exercise, parenting styles, discipline styles, emotional regulation from the parent's perspective, but also from the child's perspective. We talk about executive functioning, tech use, nutrition, diet, sleep, how you make decisions, how you communicate with other people, how you process and deal with stress, you know, and a bit of a, like a day in the life or, you know, seasons, like what does your term look like as opposed to what do your school holidays look like? So we go through a lot in that first session. And then we talk about what do you want? You know, what are you here for? And that can be very varied. It can be like, oh, I need a break, but I don't know how to get a break. So we workshop those things. It could be how to process their own diagnosis. You know, as I mentioned earlier, there's a certain sense of grief associated with getting your diagnosis. So who am I now? If that wasn't me, was that me? Hang on. I'm, you know, like there's a lot about creating a positive identity post-diagnosis. It might be that they come to me for, you know, their life is chaos, but their end goal is they want their child to be a functioning member of society, like massive. I'm talking big goals. So then we work back from there and we work on how to support your child from an educational and awareness point of view, but also from a practical point of view. So it's got to be how we can support their strengths, but how we can also problem solve with their challenges. And that's not ever, that is not telling them what to do. That is working with them. What do you think? And it's also not about how do we fix my child? It's about how do we fix the home? How do we fix the environment? How do we fix my thinking about my child? Or how do we fix my thinking about the diagnosis? Or how do we understand? How do we get our child in regards to this diagnosis?
And there are obviously so many different family dynamics that I imagine you're seeing, and so many different individuals as well, in terms of, you know, are we high functioning? Are we nonverbal? What are we actually trying to address for each individual? And of course, we can't go through every single dynamic possible. But are there things that you would consider to be somewhat universally helpful for families? Like, are there strategies that you lean on that you're like, you know what, pretty much regardless, like a bit of a catch-all, even for families that don't have any neurodivergence in their family unit, what are some things that you're like, right, everyone who has children needs to consider at least implementing this strategy or asking themselves these questions?
There are some really simple ones which a lot of, you know, you say, but you may or may not do, like meal plans, shopping lists, that kind of thing. But the key to those things is the children need to be taught where the meal plan is kept. So it then saves that questioning of what's for dinner, Mum, because they can just toddle off and read the meal plan themselves. Having the shopping list on the fridge is wonderful for mums, very stereotypical, but to write the things that they need on there, teach your children. If they use the last of the milk, write it on the list. So it's just decreasing the mental load. Of course, it's heaps faster for us to do it ourselves. but if the end goal is a functioning member of society, work backwards. Washing schedules. So instead of leaving all the washing till the weekend, you've got a giant pile, have a schedule. Every Monday I do darks. Every Wednesday I do towels. And again, that's up visual so that everybody in the house can see, oh, I don't have my, you know, whatever color school shirt. Oh, Mum hasn't done that washing, so I'm just going to have to grab a dirty one. Having a drop zone, you know, again, that's a very simple thing. I think that there's a lot of kids who just make their own drop zone. But knowing that that is the hub, anything related to school goes there. Anything related to sport goes there. So it may be a total mess in that area, but at least it's all contained within that area, so you're not looking all over the house for it. I think that there's some things to do for restoring a sense of calmness in the house, and that's for, you know, in terms of sensory overload or overwhelm, but also in terms of emotional regulation. So having things like a sensory area where they can go to, you know, there's the sequin cushions or there's the fluffy things or there's the squishmallows or there's the stress balls. But there's also within that area, you know, some emotion cards. I think you can get them from Kmart these days. So they can identify their emotion when they're there. And they, you know, I've got one child who will bring me the frustrated card and he'll throw it at me and he'll say, "That's me right now." And then he'll go back there and then he'll turn around and he'll come back later on and he'll say, "I'm this now." So just making them, you know, an area where they are, yes, calming down, but also becoming more aware of what's happening within themselves. And it doesn't have to be a room, a couch. It could just be a box that you take to them when they are being, you know, having their emotional dysregulation or that you can see they're overwhelmed. You can take it to them. So there's those kinds of things. There's also, you know, your nighttime rituals. Having, you know, calm and peace at night is not always achievable, but having certain things that you can draw on. So you don't like do five of them every night. It's like I've got a selection of 10 things and tonight we're going to listen to a story or tonight I'm going to read you a story so that you can pull on, you know, whichever one suits your own capacity too, and that they it helps to calm their nervous system down as well. And also don't overschedule the kids. I think, you know, everyone's jam-packing their days with everything that by the time they then lie in bed, they're like, "This is weird. I've stopped and, like, what's this feeling that I'm feeling right now?" So then they have trouble going to sleep because they're so wired from the day because they've been up since six and they've done sport before school, they've done school, which has totally taken everything out of their capacity to deal with life. And then in the afternoons, we're off to swimming lessons. And, you know, so there's a lot going on. But also observe. Just spend the time to observe your children in certain environments that you notice patterns. So if you notice that on the way home from school, they are just like so angry or they're, you know, they don't want to talk or, you know, whatever it is in the afternoon. And then you work out, oh, they're actually really hungry because they didn't eat at all today because the medication means that they're not hungry. So being able to take a step back and observe. Totally non-judgmental, totally neutral, just watch and see their trigger points.
Yeah, there's so much power in looking for the root cause and not just addressing the symptom. It's something that I have always felt really strongly about, particularly with toddlers. You know, it's so tempting to want to attend to like a typical toddler behavior. But if you dig a bit deeper, you can usually uncover that something else is going on. And if you address the thing that's going on, then that symptom improves. And that certainly goes across the board.
It totally resolves.
For all of us, even us as adults,
that's right?
That's right. Yeah. Where do you sit on screen time? Because lately I've heard a lot of people talk about how screens can be really regulating, particularly for kids who are somewhere along the spectrum, perhaps a little further. How do you work out if screens are, you know, working well for your family or they're not working well?
Yeah, tricky line to walk. It's definitely a, you know, dopamine hit and, you know, a way to regulate. But when they can't live without them, when they like live and breathe, like it is like they're near death until they get their device, then then their mood improves. Like that is where it's like, oh, this is not good. And again, it comes back to the awareness and the, well, first of all, the observing, and then the awareness and the education around, hey, did you notice that this was your behavior before gaming this or device? This was your behavior during, and this was your behavior after when I said time was up. And just being able to point out those things, they go, oh, yeah, yeah, I can see how you could see that, Mum. And being able to then ride the waves of emotions, like anything that you really like. I don't want to use the word addiction, but to be able to ride those waves, like you don't want, the need for those things is not that great all the time. It comes in waves, and being able to ride those waves with your children, not alone, with your children. So to ride the wave, and when they are wanting it, to kick the ball, do something physical, because they are needing a dopamine hit. They've probably sat down at school for a big portion of the day. They need to get out and do stuff, which on the flip side, as a parent, I can see and I can empathize that it's like, but I've got so many things to do that this device brings me an hour of peace and quiet and calm. And if that is all you need, go for it. But when it goes to the slippery slope is they wake up and they can't live without it.
Yeah, I guess I ask the question because I've always been a bit of a stickler with screen time, and I still am now. Like if the boys want screens, they literally say, can we do screens? Like they never just go and grab a screen and start doing it because they know that it's something that we decide together and I monitor and blah, 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 all of that stuff. But since having a diagnosis, Alison, so many people have said to me, oh, well, you can probably relax on the screens now because screens are really regulating. And I have found it hard to know what people mean. Sometimes, like, I understand that screens provide that dopamine, they meet a need, all of that stuff. But it seems to be there's this catch-all sentiment that, oh, kids that are on the spectrum need screens more. And I haven't yet understood why or how or what that means. And I'm so curious about that regulation side of things. That's why I asked the question, because I'm like, oh, maybe, like maybe that's the case. Like maybe they genuinely do need screens more. It's something I'm really interested to learn about.
I think that they are drawn, well, I don't think, I know that they are drawn to it because there is no face-to-face social interaction involved. And they get to have interactions as an avatar with an avatar, but they still interact socially. So it is filling a need, yes, and it is giving them a place to feel successful socially that is not, for lack of better words, in real life. So
yes, reducing that buffer, that dis-ease, that discomfort that comes along with so many forms of connections. That makes so much sense.
And the other thing is that a lot of children have phones so young these days, and this is a different topic but still related, that if they are already struggling socially and they don't have a phone, then they struggle even more because all the kids are on their phones. That's, they're all in the Snapchat, they're all in the social media, but my child doesn't because I don't believe in phones. And then there's that disconnect further as well.
It's so and hard it's to really, be a parent because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It's really hard.
100%. Yeah. Yep. And again, you've just got to do with what which you've got to do what works in that moment, which you can waver from. But also, I think in regards to your kids, you have spent a lot of time and energy finding alternative things for them to engage in. So the pull to the device may not be as strong for them because they're having success in other areas.
Yes, and that makes so much sense in terms of the regulation and reducing that dis-ease, allowing them a place that they feel successful and that they can win. It all makes so much sense. And even, you know, I mean, this could be the longest podcast ever. We could go down so many different tangents. But even as you were explaining that, Alison, I was thinking about how podcasts fill that need for so many people as well, because it's like being part of a conversation, but but you are allowed to be passive. You're a passenger in listening to a podcast conversation, and therefore a podcast episode can replace real connections for people who struggle socially.
Yeah, absolutely. And also that's an opportunity for autistic people to learn how neurotypicals behave. Just like when growing up you would watch, you know, Neighbours and Home and Away, because the autistics would see how neurotypicals act, and then they would have something to then model their behaviour on in order to fit in.
And that's which where then we learn how to mask.
That's exactly right.
Oh, there's so much to it. I just think it is incredible what you're doing, and I am a really big believer in the work that you're doing, because it can be such an overwhelming space to be in. And there's just nothing worse as a parent than worrying about your kids, but also feeling like your home environment is chaotic and you have that sense of like, this isn't working. But sometimes you just can't see the forest for the trees. You're so in it, and it's like, I'm just doing so many band-aid solution things. It's like band-aid on this, band-aid on that. You know, like you're turning around and you're trying to fix everything, and you don't actually even have the perspective or the space to zoom out and see what changes need to happen. So I think it's an incredible service you are offering. And I know that you work with clients on a one-on-one basis. For anyone listening who is curious about your services or wants to learn more about you and what you do, where should we send them?
Sure. So you can go to The Incremental Shift, and that is my website, and it's also on Instagram. And I've got lots of information on, particularly on the Instagram, about, you know, topics about neurodiversity and that kind of thing. And you can also book in for coaching sessions via my website as well. So that's theincrementalshift.com.
I love that. And that's what it's all about, right? It's all of those little tiny, almost invisible shifts that do add up along the way. And even the suggestions you were sharing before, I was nodding along because I'm like, yeah, as a mum especially, and of course for dads as well, but as a mum, you know, we are carrying this insane mental load. And I know with my boys, they want to run everything through my brain sometimes. And so I've had to make these little incremental shifts of like, oh, we've got a checklist that tells them what they need to do of a morning. I thought it was funny before that you mentioned meal planning and writing down dinner, because that is a question that just we get asked all the time. What's for dinner? What's for dinner? What's for dinner? And we've only got like six meals on rotation. Like, it's not this huge, like, exciting thing to find out. But having that written down somewhere that they can access that information, it's all about just taking stuff off your own mental plate and like stopping them from having that, I guess, having the action of running everything through your brain that really does make a huge difference to allowing you as a parent to observe the things that are happening for your kids and to observe your own feelings and to have a much calmer household. So I think it's really cool what you're offering families. And I will make sure that we have all of the links in our show notes. Is there anything else that you wanted to leave our listeners with?
It's a big journey. It's a really big journey. And whether that is with a diagnosed child or not, even if there's just traits or behaviours that seem like autism or ADHD or something else, it's a lot. And the process is long and you will not solve everything overnight. In fact, nothing will be solved overnight. So take time and be kind to yourself, and also be kind to the children, because you've got more of an awareness than they do. So giving them time and space and just love on them.
Yeah, beautiful. Alison, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge today. As mentioned, all of your details will be in our show notes, and I definitely encourage everyone to jump on over and follow The Incremental Shift on Instagram, because you have so much wonderful education that you pop up and you share. So thank you.
Thanks, Kylie.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast episode. If you want more of the I Am podcast in your ears, make sure you become a podcast subscriber. It is really, really simple to do. All of the details are in the show notes. For the cost, actually less than the cost of a cup of coffee per month, you will receive access to exclusive podcast episodes. That's right, you'll get a bonus episode every single week that you will not hear anywhere else. And to be honest with you, I really am sharing a lot more over in those exclusive episodes. It feels like a really safe zone for me. So make sure you check out the subscription offers that we do have available for that exclusive content. And perhaps best of all of the episodes will be ad-free. So if you feel good about supporting a female-founded, female-led business, check out the subscription offerings available and become a podcast supporter today. Today's podcast episode was recorded on the land of the Bundjalung Nation. In the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.